From Boston, National Public Radio, in cooperation with WGBH Radio, now presents the Ford Hall Forum, now in its 75th year. I'm Greg Fitzgerald, and on this program, Dr. Leonard Peikoff, associate and friend of the late Ayn Rand, will discuss Assault from the Ivory Tower, the professor's war against America.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Around the world, intellectuals as a class take a certain pride, whether deserved or not, in their own country's achievements and traditions. When they lash out at some villain, it is not their nation, but some group allegedly threatening it, such as the rich, the West, the Jews, or whatever. This pattern is true of Canada, from which I originally came, and it is true to my knowledge of England, France, Germany, China, you name it. But it is not true of America. One of the most striking things to me when I first came here was the disapproval, the resentment, even the hatred of America. I mean of the country as such and of most things American that I saw displayed by American intellectuals, especially by professors in the humanities and social sciences whom I got to know the best. Typically, these professors regard the American political system, capitalism, as primitive, anachronistic, selfish. They tell their classes that the American past is a brutal record of injustice, whether to the poor, or to the third world, or to the fish, or to the ethnic group of the moment. They describe the American people as materialistic, insensitive, racist. They seem to regard most things European or oriental or even primitive as interesting, cultured, potentially deep. And anything characteristically American, from rugged individualism to moon landings to tap dancing to hamburgers, as junk, as superficial, vulgar, philistine. When the new left, taught by these same professors, erupted a while back, the student rebels expressed their philosophy by desecrating the American flag, blowing their noses in it, using it to patch the seat of their pants, and so on. I do not know another country in which anti-patriotism has ever been the symbol of an ideology on such a scale. It happened here, in my opinion, because America at root is an ideology. America is the only country in history created not by some meaningless warfare or geographical accident, but deliberately on the basis of certain fundamental ideas. The Founding Fathers explicitly championed a certain philosophy, which they made the basis of America's distinctive political institutions and national character. And that philosophy, to some extent, survives among the people here to this day. That's why the professors I mentioned can feel at home and at peace anywhere else in the world, but not here. The fundamental ideas of the Founding Fathers are anathema to today's intellectuals. The war against America mentioned in the title of my talk is not a political or anti-capitalist war as such. That is merely a result, a last consequence. The war I want to discuss is deeper. It's the assault against the founding philosophy of this country, which is now being conducted by our universities, being conducted not only by radicals and by leftists, but also by most of the mainstream, respectable moderates on the faculties. There are exceptions. There are professors still carrying on some traditions from a better era. But these men are not a power in our colleges, merely a remnant of the past that has not yet fully died out. The basic philosophic credo of the United States was eloquently stated two centuries ago by Elihu Palmer, a spokesman of the revolutionary era. I quote a brief passage. "The strength of the human understanding is incalculable. Its keenness of discernment would ultimately penetrate into every part of nature were it permitted to operate with uncontrolled and unqualified freedom," unquote. At last, he goes on, men have escaped from the mind-destroying ideas of the Middle Ages. They have grasped, quote, the unlimited power of human reason, reason which is the glory of our nature, unquote. Now, he says, men should feel an unqualified confidence in their mental powers and energy, and they should proceed to remake the world accordingly. Such was the basic approach of the men who threw off the shackles of the past and built this nation. Now let me quote a bit, more or less at random, from some modern college teachers. In preparation for this talk, I asked objectivists around the country to tell me what they were being taught in college on basic issues. I received a flood of eloquent mail and clippings, for which I am very grateful, and I would like to share some of it with you. First, an excerpt from a textbook on the craft of writing composed by some professors of rhetoric at the University of California at Berkeley. Quote, what do Plato's opinions, or any other writer's opinions we might choose to study, have to do with learning to write? Everything. Before anything good can come out of writing, the students must at least sense the presuppositions of the writer in his civilization. And the first presupposition is this: we do not really know, surely and indubitably, the answer to any important question. Other cultures know such answers, or think they do, and writing is consequently a very different experience for them. But we collectively do not. It would be very comfortable to be able to act upon the basis of immutable truth, but it is not available to us. Unquote. Note here the statement of pure philosophic skepticism. Truth is not available to us. There is no knowledge. And this is offered as a flat statement, uncontroversial, even self-evident. Now I want to quote from the Washington Post, from a story about a symposium held at Catholic University dealing with Galileo's famous clash defending his own beliefs against the Inquisition. At one point, a prominent Harvard astronomer made an offhand comment contrasting Galileo's attitude toward scientific beliefs with that of modern scientists. Here is the story in the paper. Quote, today in science, the professor said, there is no belief as such, only probability. A man in the audience, I'm still quoting, visibly emotional, stood up. I cannot credit it, he said. I cannot believe you would say that scientists do not really believe in the objects they study. Do you really think it's possible that astronomical science is all wrong, he demanded. Yes, said the astronomer, it is possible. We cannot, he went on, know that there are atoms or what stars are. And then a quote from the astronomer. Scientists now cannot fail to remember that absolute reality collapsed just after the turn of the century with Einstein. Since then, one simply cannot speak of certainties, of what is real and what is not. I cannot believe it, muttered the man in the audience as he sat down. Unquote. He better believe it. This viewpoint is standard today. The gospel is that the latest scientific discoveries invalidate everything we thought we once knew and prove that reality is inaccessible to our minds. If so, one might ask, what is it that scientists are studying? If we can know nothing, how did Einstein arrive at his discoveries and how do we know that they're right? And if certainty is ungraspable and inconceivable, how do we decide how close we are to it, which is what a probability estimate is? But it's no use asking such questions because the cause of the modern skepticism is not Einstein nor any scientific discoveries. Now let me give you another brief statement. One objectivist undergraduate at Columbia University wrote for a composition course a research paper presenting the Founding Fathers' view of reason. The student was sympathetic to the Founding Fathers' view, though not explicitly so. The teacher several times put question marks beside phrases that bothered her, for example, beside facts of reality, or wrote marginal comments such as, do you really believe this? At the end, she summed up, quote, this paper is very well written. It's difficult for me to see how we can write about reason without the 19th century's sad discovery in mind that the belief that reason will help us get better and better meant naivety in many senses. Let's discuss. Unquote. In discussion, the student told me the teacher said that the 19th century had established the inability of reason to know reality. Freud in particular, she said, had refuted the founding fathers. And the teacher was supposed to have said, quote, he showed that man is really an irrational creature and that the Enlightenment idea that all our problems can be solved by reason is quite unjustified, unquote. The founding fathers, as thinkers of the Enlightenment era, championed the power of man's unaided intellect. It was on this basis, after centuries of European tyranny, that they urged the right to liberty, which was the right of each man to rely in action on his own mind's judgment. They upheld this right because they believed that the human mind is reliable, that properly employed, it can reach a knowledge of reality and give the individual the guidance he needs to live. The individual, they held, does not have to submit blindly to any authority, whether church or state, because he has within himself a brilliant and potent cognitive tool to direct him. Reason, the only oracle of man, said Ethan Allen. Oracle in the sense of source of absolute objective truth. There is no such truth, said the antipode and destroyer of the founding father's legacy. And I mean the philosopher Immanuel Kant. Kant is the basic cause of the modern anti-reason trend. He is the man who, 200 years ago, launched an unprecedented attack on the power of the human mind, declared that reason is in principle incapable of knowing reality, and thereby put an end to the Enlightenment. Freud was merely one of his many heirs, as are the modern skeptics who distort Einstein's findings to rationalize their viewpoint, as are the rhetoric professors at Berkeley and all their like-minded colleagues. In countless forms, it is Kant's rejection of reason, which is at the root of our modern colleges. Question, debate, dispute, the founding fathers urged men, because by this means you will reach answers to your questions and discover how to act. Question, debate, dispute, our Kantianized faculty urges today, not to find the answers, but to realize that there aren't any, and that there are no sources of truth and no guide to action, that the Enlightenment view was merely a comfortable superstition, a naivete. Come to college, they say, and we'll cure you of that superstition for life, which unfortunately they often do. On the first day of classes, a student from Kent State University in Ohio wrote me. My English professor said, the purpose of college is to take a high school graduate who's sure of himself and make him confused. Kent fulfills that objective perfectly, the writer adds. Not only, he went on in its insistent pro-skepticism propaganda, but also in its very method of presenting the course material. And I quote from this person, quote, its courses are a hodgepodge of random and contradictory information that can't possibly be integrated into a consistent whole, and one of the first things it teaches its students is not to bother to try. The typical Kent graduate leaves the school feeling bewildered, vaguely pleased that his bewilderment must mean he came out of college smarter than when he went in, and vaguely displeased that his enlightened confusion hasn't made him happier than it has, unquote. This is an exact description of many current graduates, and unfortunately not only in Ohio. That English professor's statement of the purpose of college was not a wisecrack. It was meant and practiced as a serious pedagogical principle. We have reached a variant of the inverted slogans of Orwell's 1984. The claim to knowledge we are being taught betrays ignorance. Knowledge is ignorance, but confusion is enlightenment. That is what you can hope to achieve after tens of thousands of dollars in tuition and 4 years of study and agonizing term papers, a BC degree, a Bachelor of Confusion. Now, you might ask, if no one can know the truth, why are these professors bothering to pursue their subjects at all? Some, of course, purport to be attaining probability by unspecified means. But some are more modern and more open. Here is another teacher from Columbia, this time from the Graduate School of Business, offering a course entitled Individual and Collective Behavior. According to one of his students, this teacher stated in class, quote, that psychological theories cannot be proved. He added that this was a good thing since it provided scope for further research, unquote. Do you get that one? If we could prove a psychological theory, that would eliminate a whole area of research. There would be no need to investigate that particular question because we would already have proved the answer. On the other hand, if we can never know, we can go on looking forever with no ugly barriers such as knowledge to stand in the way. But why then look? Why is research good if we never prove anything by it? Obviously, it's an end in itself. You do research in order to get research grants from the government. In order to write papers and get promotions so that other researchers can attack your papers and thereby get more grants to finance more research for more studies. Forever. With a voluminous literature on the weirdest, most senseless subjects pouring out, which everyone must study and no one can integrate or even keep up with, and with everyone agreeing that none of it proves anything. All of it a giant academic con game divorced from cognition, from human life, from reality. Such is the nature of research under the reign of skepticism. No one can be a consistent skeptic. A man literally devoid of all knowledge would be like a newborn baby, unable to act or function at all. Skeptics, therefore, despite their viewpoint, have to find something to rely on and follow as a guide. And what most of them choose to follow ultimately is the opinion of others, the group, society. Kant gave this approach a complex philosophic defense. There are, he said, two realities. There's reality as it is in itself, which is unknowable, and there is the reality we live in and deal with, the physical world, which, he says, mankind itself creates. The physical world, he says, is created by subjective but universal mechanisms inherent in the human mind. An idea which is merely the product of an individual brain on this view may or may not be acceptable. But an idea universal to the mind of the species can necessarily be relied on, because that defines reality for us. That is what creates reality, at least our private, subjective, human reality. Under all its complexities and qualifications, and there are mountains of them, this doctrine amounts to saying the individual's mind is helpless, but the group, mankind, is cognitively all-powerful. If mankind collectively holds an idea, that is truth. Not the objective, real truth, of course, we can't know that, but subjective human truth, which is the only truth we can know. The founding fathers, being champions of reason, were champions as a result of the individual. Reason they held as an attribute of each man alone, by himself. The power of the mind means the power of the individual. With today's anti-reason trend, however, such individualism simply disappears. In our colleges today, alongside Kant's skepticism about true reality, there is also this other element of Kant, the one systematically promoted, I might add, by Hegel and Marx, the exaltation of the social. The student gets a powerful double message. Skepticism, you can't know anything, there is no certainty, and society knows. You must adapt to its beliefs. Who are you to question the consensus? Here is a small example of the second from a psychology textbook written by a professor at the University of North Carolina. Let me preface this by saying that philosophers before Kant used to distinguish two sources of knowledge: experience, which led to empirical knowledge, and reason, which led to rational knowledge. These two were conceived with whatever errors as faculties of the individual, enabling him to reach truth. Now here is their new Kantian definitions. Quote, empirical knowledge is the agreement in reports of repeated observations made by two or more persons. Rational knowledge is the agreement in results of problem solving by two or more persons, unquote. In other words, the genus of knowledge is agreement. The fundamental of knowledge is a social consideration. Not the relationship of your mind to reality, but to other men. The individual by himself on a desert island cannot learn. He is cut off from the possibility of any knowledge because he can't tabulate agreement or disagreement. Empirical observation is not using your eyes, but taking a Gallup poll of others' reports on their eyes. Rational knowledge is not achieved by your brain putting forth a logical argument. It is agreement in results of problem solving. And if men happen not to agree, for whatever reason or lack of reason, then there is no rational knowledge. This is nothing less than public ownership of the means of cognition. Which, as Ayn Rand observed, is much more ominous than public ownership of the means of production. Now, if you want to see both Kantian elements, skepticism and the worship of the social, come together, consider the field of history today. Here is an excerpt from a course description at the University of Indiana in Bloomington. The course is titled Freedom and the Historian. Quote, "History is made by the historian. Each generation of historians reinterprets the past in the light of its own historical experience and values. There can be thus no one definitive history of Alexander and no one historical truth about the fall of the Roman Empire. There have been as many concepts of history, as many views of historical truth as there have been cultures." Unquote. The skeptical theme here is clear. There is no one definitive history, no one historical truth. An old-fashioned person, even a skeptic, would react, "Well then, let's close down the field if we can't know the truth." But not the moderns. "We can't know the real truth," they say, "but we can know the subjective truth that we ourselves create. History is made by the historian. If there's a consensus of historians, therefore, their viewpoint is valid and worth studying for that time and culture. As in Kant, there are two realities. The real past, which is unknowable, and the private world each generation creates, its own subjective historical truth." Notice that in this viewpoint, the historian is at once helpless and omnipotent. He can know nothing really, but on the other hand, he's the creator of history, of the history that we can know, and so he is an unchallengeable authority. If any student disagrees with the fraternity of historians, therefore, he has no chance. On the one side, he hears, "Who are you to know? There are no definitive facts." On the other, he hears, "History is made by the historian. Who are you to question it?" Observe, by the way, what people allow themselves when hiding behind a group. If the author of that course description were to say, "History is made by me," he would be dismissed as a paranoid personality. But when he says it collectively, "History is made by us, by our guild, by historians," that's acceptable. This is the exaltation of the social generated by Kant. And there is a further development of the Kantian approach here. Why, historians soon began to ask, should the social authority be universal? Why can't there be many groups of historians, each creating history in accordance with its own mental structure, each version being true for that group, though not for the others? Why, in effect, shouldn't we be democratic and let every collective into the act? The result of this line of thinking is pressure group history, a kind of pluralization of the Kantian approach in which each group rewrites the past according to its own predilections, and every group's views are deemed to be as valid or invalid as every other group's. To be progressive in history today means precisely this. It means to respect the rewriting of all the newest groups, especially if it makes no sense to you, because that shows that you are open-minded and are not trying to impose your group's private views on other groups. To each his own subjectivism, in effect. Now, is this an exaggeration? A prominent history professor at Stanford University, Carl Degler, I'm naming the famous ones, recently made a plea for women's history, explaining that history varies subjectively from men to women. He declared, quote, "The real test of the success of affirmative action for women will come not by counting the number or proportion of women in a department or profession, but by the extent to which men are willing to accept the new and peculiar interests of women as legitimate and serious, even when those interests are strikingly novel and perhaps even bizarre." when compared with current acceptable work in a given field, unquote. I once heard a feminist intellectual on TV declare that the central fact of the ages is rape, and that the culmination of the historical process is the discovery of the clitoral orgasm, which has finally freed women from men. Now, this is surely an approach to history which is strikingly novel and even bizarre. But it seems that we must not be chauvinistic. History is made by historians, and if a certain group begins to push a certain line and organizes into a new pressure unit, it becomes true for them, as true as any other claim in this world where no one can really know anything. This is what I call Kantianized history. The founding fathers, as men of the Enlightenment, were champions of dispassionate objectivity. Any form of subjectivism or of emotion-driven cognition was considered reprehensible by them, but not today. If objectivity is not possible to man, as the Kantians hold, then in the end anything goes, including any kind of errant emotionalism. And the humanities and social sciences end up not as academic disciplines teaching facts, but as the preserve of shifting lobbyists disseminating sheer propaganda, which is what is increasingly happening today in our colleges. History is merely one example of it. The field of anthropology offers another eloquent illustration. First, we read a few months ago about the scandal of Margaret Mead. You know that in her famous 1928 book, Coming of Age in Samoa, Ms. Mead presented an idyllic picture of life in Samoa. The natives, she claimed, were gentle, peaceful, devoid of jealousy, free of stress, etc. It was Rousseau over again, the noble savage. And Miss Mead's implicit moral was the superiority of primitive culture over competitive, repressed Western society. Now, finally, a true scholar, Derek Freeman, an anthropologist from New Zealand, has set the record straight. After years of study in Samoa, he concluded, and I quote the New York Times summary, that the Samoans have high rates of homicide and assault, and the incident of rape is among the world's highest. They live within an authority system that regularly results in psychological disturbances ranging from compulsive behaviors to hysterical illnesses and suicide. They are extremely prone to jealousy and so on. So, Ms. Mead's claims in some are, quote, fundamentally in error and some of them preposterously false, unquote. From what one can gather from the press, anthropologists had known some of this for some time, but few had wanted to challenge Miss Mead publicly. Why not? Well, aside from a nature-nurture controversy which got involved, two other main reasons were operative as far as I can see. One was the feeling that Miss Mead's viewpoint, her endorsement of primitive society over Western civilization, is noble, moral, good. The second is a pervasive which makes a potential dissenter feel, I can't be sure. Anybody can claim to prove or disprove anything. Anthropology is whatever anthropologists say. Why jump in and start a fight with a saint in the field for nothing? Now couple this episode with another recent scandal in anthropology. Did you read about the doctoral candidate from Stanford who, while studying in Red China, found that abortions were being forcibly performed on helpless women after the sixth month of pregnancy, when it is a dangerous, bloody practice, and who published this news in a Taiwanese weekly complete with photographs? The Chinese were furious, though the truth of his charges is not debated, and the Stanford Anthropology Department expelled the student from Stanford for unethical conduct, in effect for blowing the whistle on his host country, an allegedly unforgivable sin among scholars. As one radio talk show host in New York, Barry Farber, pointed out, can you imagine the Stanford Anthropology Department expelling a student for doing exactly the same thing in regard to South Africa, for publishing articles about that regime's racial crimes? Such a student would have been treated as an academic hero. The double standard involved in the two cases is clear. One scholar, Margaret Mead, who condemns the West, becomes a revered figure for decades, even though her factual claims are dead wrong. Another who prints the uncontested truth about a communist dictatorship is expelled from his discipline. Is this fairness? Is this objectivity? Or is this the complete politicization of the field? But we must remember that Kantians declare that there is no objectivity, and that truth is whatever the group wants to be. In the social sciences today, they don't leave much doubt about what they want it to be. I must quote one further example of today's subjectivist trend, simply to indicate to you how brazen it is becoming. The recent issue of the National Law Journal describes a new development in the teaching of law in our universities, a development sponsored by a law professor from State University of New York at Buffalo, a sociologist from the University of Pennsylvania, and many others. They all, and I quote, agree that an objective legal mode of reasoning, distinguishable from the society where it is being applied and the people applying it, and capable of yielding an inevitable result, does not exist. Continuing the quote, that law, by its mask of objectivity, functions chiefly to legitimize social and economic inequalities in the eyes of the lower classes as a way of keeping them docile. That because democracy is a good and the law is a shell, the goal is to found a government not by law but by people, unquote. This statement is a union of Kant and Marx. Let me translate it. There is no objective legal reasoning. Law pretends to be objective, but really it's an instrument of the wealthy to keep the poor docile. Law, in effect, is the opiate of the masses. This is law professors speaking, mind you. And our goal should be a system run not by law, but by people. Well, how are the people to govern themselves if not by reference to an objective code of laws? How are they to settle their disputes and resolve conflicting claims? There's only one alternative to government by law: government by pressure group. In other words, by each group struggling to seize control of the legislature and the courts, and then ramming its arbitrary desires down the throats of the rest until they rebel and start ramming their desires, etc. All of it a naked exercise in power politics of group each group without the pretense of objectivity or justice. One of the great achievements of Western civilization was the concept of a society in which men are not at the mercy of clashing groups, but can resolve their disputes fairly by reference to impersonal principle. This is what used to be called a government of laws and not of men. Today we have the frightening spectacle of law professors telling us that what we need is a government of men and not of laws. If this group needs a name, they should call themselves lawyers for gang warfare. Philosophy sets the standards for every school and department within a university. When philosophy goes bad, corrupt manifestations turn up everywhere. Go, for instance, to Stanford's Graduate School of Business and audit a course entitled Creativity in Business, offered to MBA candidates. San Francisco Chronicle describes it as follows, quote, the students learn meditation and chanting, analyze dreams, paint pictures, study I Ching and tarot cards. The course reading includes I Am That by Swami Muktananda, a book called Precision Nirvana, yoga aphorisms, and others. I continue the quote. One woman who had been a Mooney earlier in her life was fearful after a couple of sessions that she was getting into the same sort of thing, said the professor. It's nothing of the kind, he added, but the heavy emphasis on developing the intuitive side of a student's mind, where creativity is expressed, can sometimes leave that impression, unquote. Now switch fields again for a moment. Turn to the area of sex education and read a text widely used in junior high and high schools, cited by the American Library Association as one of the best books for young adults in 1978. This book claims to impressionable teenagers that anything in sex is acceptable as long as those who do it feel no guilt. Among other practices, the book explicitly endorses transvestism, prostitution, open marriage, sadomasochism, and bestiality. In regard to this latter, however, the book cautions the youngster to avoid, quote, poor hygiene, injury by the animal or to the animal, or guilt on the part of the human, unquote. Or if you want still more, turn to art, for instance, poetry, as it's taught today in our colleges. For an eloquent example, read the widely used Norton Introduction to Poetry and see what modern poems are offered to students alongside the recognized classics of the past as equally deserving of study, analysis, respect. One typical entry, for example, which directly follows a poem by Blake, is entitled Hard Rock Returns to Prison from the Hospital for the Criminal Insane. The poem begins, quote, Hard Rock was known not to take no shit from nobody, unquote, and continues in similar vein throughout. This item can be topped only by the volume's editor, who discusses the poem reverently, even explaining that it has a profound social message, which is the despair of the hopeless. Just as history is what historians say, so art today is supposed to be whatever the art world endorses, and this is the kind of stuff it is endorsing now. After all the modernists say, who is to say what's really good in art? It's all subjective, and a Hard Rock's feelings are just as good as Tennyson's or Milton's. On this, I forego further comment. Our colleges are allegedly open to all ideas. Yet on all the key issues of philosophy, you hear everywhere the same one rigid, dogmatic viewpoint, just as though they were under censorship. I was at Columbia's graduation exercises last year, and the priest who delivered the invocation declared to the assembled graduates, "The age of individual achievement is past. When you come to Columbia, you're not to be motivated by the desire for money or personal ambition or success. You're here to learn to serve. And my prayer for you today," he said, "is that at the end of your life, you will be able to say, Lord, I have been an unworthy servant." Unquote. If that priest had come out with the plug for the Communist Party, it would have caused a stir. If he had upheld the superiority of Catholicism, ditto. But to state as self-evident the moral code common to both did not cause a ripple. Now let me mention the work of a social psychologist from Harvard who has devised a test to measure a person's level of moral reasoning. This test, by the way, is the basis of many of the new courses in morality now being offered in schools around the country. The test involves giving the student a hypothetical situation and several possible responses to it. He then chooses the response that best fits his own attitude. Here's a typical example, quote, "Your spouse is dying from a rare cancer, and doctors believe a drug recently discovered by the town pharmacist may provide a cure. The pharmacist, however, charges $2,000 for the drug, which costs only $200 to make. You can't afford the drug and can't raise the money," unquote. That's the situation. Now, before we proceed to the answers, observe what moral issues a student would absorb from the statement of the problem alone. Morality does not pertain to normal situations. It's not concerned with how to live, he learns, but with how to meet disaster, death, terminal cancer. The obstacle to his values, he learns, is greed. The greed of the pharmacist who is trying to exploit him by charging 10 times the cost of the product. There's no mention of any effort the pharmacist might have had to exert to discover the drug. No mention of any research or thought or study required to discover an unprecedented cure for cancer. No mention of any costs he may have incurred. No question of any gratitude to the man who alone has created the power to save the spouse. No mention of any reason why that pharmacist, counter to every principle of self-interest, would overcharge for the drug when he would make much more money by selling in quantity at a lower price, as the whole history of industrial mass production shows. All of this in an exercise designed to teach moral reasoning is simply omitted as irrelevant. Nor is there any explanation of why the student can't raise money. No reference to banks or savings or relatives. The case is simple. Senseless greed on the part of a callous inventor, and what do you do about it? Now comes the answers. Six choices, you have to choose one. The answers are given in ascending order, the lowest first. The lowest is not to steal the drug. Not out of respect for property rights, that doesn't even enter on the lowest rung of the test, but out of fear of jail. The other five answers all advocate stealing the drug. They merely differ in their reasons. Here are the three most moral reasons, according to the test. Number four, see four, five, and six. Number four, I would steal the drug because I have a duty springing from the marriage vow I took. Five, I would steal the drug because the right to life is higher than the right to property. Six, I would steal the drug because I respect the dignity of human beings. I should act in the best interest of mankind, unquote. Here is an eloquent example of what Ayn Rand has amply demonstrated. The ethics of self-sacrifice is not concerned with the dignity of human beings or with the best interest of mankind. It is the destroyer of human dignity and of mankind because it's incompatible with the requirements of human life. It scorns and dismisses as irrelevant thought, effort, work, achievement, property, everything life requires. All of it is to be sacrificed, the altruist claims, sacrificed to that which has the first right on earth, pain. Pain as such, weakness, illness, suffering, regardless of its cause. This is the penalization of success for being success, and the rewarding of failure for being failure. What Ayn Rand called the hatred of the good for being the good. And it is now being taught to our children, courtesy of a Harvard authority, as an example of high-quality moral reason. As to what will happen to the weak and the sick after the able and the productive are demeaned, expropriated, and throttled, read Atlas Shrugged or look at Soviet Russia. Now, did Miss Rand exaggerate in saying that altruists wish to sacrifice thought to pain? Well, let me quote from a Dental Product Report magazine in 1982. I don't know firsthand whether this item is true. I hope not. Quote, some medical schools in the United States are considering major changes in the traditional curriculum requirements for pre-med and medical students. Harvard, for example, is considering abolishing requirements for pre-med science and instead requiring courses stressing compassion and understanding and dealing with patients. Unquote. Our doctors may not study much science any longer, but they will be able to express compassion to the suffering, who will suffer endlessly and without any chance of relief because the doctors will no longer be wasting their time on science or thought. This is a perfect fiction-like example of an altruistic curriculum change, if ever I heard one. Now let's sum up the overall philosophy advocated by the dominant consensus in today's colleges. Reality has collapsed. Reason is naive. Achievement is unnecessary and unreal. I sometimes fantasize the ideal modern curriculum, which would capture explicitly the philosophy of the modern university. And recently I found it. I found three actual courses offered at three different schools, one covering each basic branch of philosophy, the sum indicating the naked essence of the modern trend. For metaphysics, we go to the University of Delaware in Newark for an interdisciplinary honors course entitled Nothing. The subtitle, A Study of Nil, Void, Vacuum, Null, Zero, and Other Kinds of Nothingness. The description, quote, a lecture course exploring the varieties of nothingness, from the vacuum and void of physics and astronomy to political nihilism to the emptiness of the arts and the soul, unquote. That's our view of reality. Nothing. For epistemology, we move to NYU. For a course titled Theory of Knowledge, the description, quote, various theories of knowledge are discussed, including the view that they are all inadequate. And that, in fact, nobody knows anything. The consequences of skepticism are explored for thought, action, language, and emotional relations, unquote. We end up for ethics at Indiana with a course entitled Social Reactions to Handicaps, the description of which reads in part, quote, this course will explore some of the different ways in which the handicapped individual and the idea of handicap have been regarded in Western civilization. figures from the past such as the fool, the madman, the blind beggar, and the witch will be discussed. There was once a time when college students studied facts, knowledge, and human greatness. Now they study nothingness, ignorance, and the fool, the madman, the blind beggar, and the witch. If the philosophic message taught by our colleges is clear to you, the political views of the faculties require very little discussion. Politics is a last consequence of philosophy. The precondition of capitalism is egoism, and beneath that, the efficacy of reason. The consequence of unreason and self-sacrifice is the idea the individual is helpless on his own and has no value anyway, and therefore should merge himself into the group and obey its spokesman, the state. In other words, given today's basic ideas, the collectivism and statism of the faculties are inevitable and too obvious to need any documentation. What I do want to mention is the end result politically of our current trend. In my book, The Ominous Parallels, I argue that the intellectuals are preparing us ultimately for a totalitarian dictatorship. This may seem like an exaggeration, so I want to offer one last quote tonight. This one from a philosopher, Richard Rorty, long at Princeton, now at the University of Virginia. Professor Rorty, himself a thorough modern, does not shrink from spelling out the final consequences of the modern viewpoint. Whatever you think of him, he states his ideas forthrightly. There is no truth, he holds. There is no philosophy. There are no objective standards by which to evaluate or criticize social and political practices. No matter what is done to the citizens of a country, therefore, he says, they can have no objective grounds on which to protest. Once, he writes, men could criticize dictators, at least in their own minds. They could say to the dictator, quote, there is something within you which you are betraying. Though you embody the practices of a totalitarian society which will endure forever, there is something beyond those practices which condemns you, unquote. Once, he says, we could have said that, but no longer. Now we know that there is no knowledge, no values, no standards to appeal to or rely on. Now we must accept the fact, quote, that we have not once seen the truth, and so will not intuitively recognize it when we see it again. And I'm continuing to quote. This means that when the secret police come, when the torturers violate the innocent, there is nothing to be said to them, unquote. Professor Rorty, I may say, claims to be disturbed by this result, but he is propagating it vigorously all the same. Ladies and gentlemen, higher education today has a remarkable press. We hear over and over about the value of our colleges and universities, their importance to the nation, our need to contribute financially to their survival and growth. In many of the professional and scientific schools, this is true enough. But in the arts, the humanities, the social sciences, the opposite is true. In those areas, with some rare exceptions, our colleges and universities are a national menace. And the better the university, such as Harvard or Columbia or Berkeley, the worse it is. Our college faculties now are dominantly hostile to every idea on which this country was founded. They are corrupting an entire generation of students, and they are leading the United States thereby to slavery and destruction. Now, what is the solution? The only answer to a corrupt philosophy is a rational philosophy. And the only way to spread a rational philosophy today is through the universities. The universities today, not the churches and not the press or the media. The universities are the main transmitters of philosophy. They are what sets the tone and direction of a culture. To those of you of college age, therefore, I mean the ones who don't subscribe to Kant's philosophy, I want to say that the moral of my talk is not quit college. On the contrary, if you're considering college or already in it, I urge you to enter or stay. Stay and fight the system. Try to get some other ideas. Some pro-American ideas are hearing. The colleges pretend to be open to all viewpoints, even though they're not. The only hope is to make them live up to their false propaganda. If you give up the colleges, you give up the chance of having any role in the decisive battle for the world the intellectual battle. I am not suggesting you become a martyr or enter into arguments with professors who will penalize you for your ideas. Not all of them, however, will. And I'm speaking within the context and limits of rational self-interest. Within that context, I say speak up where appropriate, let your voice be heard on campus, try to stick it out and get your degree. Come back to teach if you can get in and if that's the life work you want. And if you're an alumnus, be careful what kind of academic programs you contribute your money to. In this battle, every word, man, and penny counts. I wish I could tell you that your college years will be a glorious crusade. Actually, they will probably be a miserable experience, as I know from many years in the field. If you are a philosophically pro-American student, you have to expect every kind of smear from many of your professors. If you uphold the power of reason, you will be called a fanatic or a dogmatist. If you uphold the right to happiness, you will be called antisocial or even a fascist. If you admire Ayn Rand, you will be called a religious cultist. You will experience every kind of injustice and even hatred. You will be very bored a great deal of the time, and often, I'm afraid, you will be alone and lonely. But if you have the courage to venture out into this kind of nightmare, you will not only be acquiring the diploma necessary for your professional future, you will also be helping to save the world, and we are all in your debt. The young lady who typed this speech for me said at this point, "It's pretty depressing." Aren't you going to end on an inspiring note? I wish I could think of one. All I can come up with in this context is the possibility that objectivists may start a better university someday, which would offer a real alternative to the current scene and offer sanctuary to the kind of young minds now being tortured by the establishment. But this project, though possible, is still far from being a reality. To those of you in the college trenches today, therefore, I have only a bleak ending, I'm afraid. To you, I want to say in conclusion, even if I am an atheist, I know no better way to say it. God bless you and God help you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Peacock, for a very invigorating presentation. I hope we can have in a few moments some inspiring questions that might add to the end of your remarks. But while you are formulating those questions according to the principles of good grammar, I thought that I could take an opportunity to make two additional announcements which may be of interest to you. First, Judge Cass, at the opening of the meeting this evening, mentioned an auction of memorabilia at the gala on Saturday night, and included in that portion of the evening's activities is a manuscript of Ayn Rand entitled The Intellectual Bankruptcy of Our Age, and is a copy of the remarks delivered here at the forum in 1961. The second announcement is that if you desire to have information about objectivism and its activities, schools, publications, courses, and other materials, there is one all-purpose address, very simple, which you might like to hear once. And that is very simply Box 177, Murray Hill Station, New York City. Zip code isn't even necessary at that point. It's a plain and ordinary address, Box 177, Murray Hill Station, New York City. Now, why don't we start over on this side of the hall and see if there is a question for our speaker. Yes, sir. Our speaker asks if it is a part of the philosophy to not give any kind of support to the Soviet Union. How is it possible with so many companies doing business to discern when we are and are not giving such support?
Well, it's correct that according to objectivism, you should not sanction any totalitarian dictatorship, communist or Nazi, and that would include that you should not trade with them or purchase their products. This does not mean, however, that you have an obligation to inventory the political beliefs or the economic practices of the stores that you deal with. It's exactly parallel to the fact that you should not deal with an axe murderer. But this doesn't mean when you walk into each store, you ask the guy if he or any of his main clerks have just committed an axe murder. The presumption is innocent until proven guilty. If there is a case where it's clear that the person is dealing with the Soviet Union and products, you avoid it. But if you don't know it, you can't be required to take a political poll before you make daily purchases.
There was a question here in red. Yes, sir. We have our annual question. could you give us this year's update on the production of a film version of the novel Atlas Shrugged?
Well, after 1 year of negotiations, I can tell you on the negative side, there will definitely not be a network television miniseries. There will not be. I had reason to believe that one of the networks was interested. It got beyond simply the talking stage. The major star was interested in becoming, in taking the role of Reardon. It was on the verge. I was told by a seasoned observer of Hollywood affairs that the network turned it down despite the star and the guarantee virtually of popularity because of its ideology. In effect, the networks have integrity, they live up to their ideas, and they will not permit a pro-capitalist viewpoint on the airwaves. They would rather go out of business than permit it. However, that leaves still two avenues of approach. At the present time, we are trying to put together a television miniseries which would take place either on the level of syndicated television, non-network, but national network, national group of stations, and or cable television. That is now presently being discussed. These things take a long time to decide. If that falls through, then the line of last resort is a theatrical movie, which will definitely take place. But when, I can't tell you further than that. I'm sorry.
There was another question on the side. Yes. You, questioner asks that you once reported the possibility of a new course on rationalist thinking. Do you have progress you can tell us about?
Yes, I'm offering that course, I think, that you referred to this fall in New York City. Basically, I don't have a title for it yet, but it's going to be a course on what to do in your own mind with philosophic ideas in order to pass from the stage where you say, yes, I agree with that, to the stage where it's actually a part of your mental equipment, you really understand it, integrate it, and can deal with it and apply it in your writing, thinking, and daily life. In effect, a course on how to digest philosophy, and specifically objectivism. And one essential ingredient in that course will be two wrong things that you can do. One called rationalism and the other called empiricism, in contrast to what the objectivist view will be. That course will be offered in New York in the fall and be available on tape in 1984.
And again over and through here? Yes, in the toward the rear, yes. Go ahead, go ahead. Yeah. Without putting on you the responsibility for the forum's presentation of a number of speakers who have contradicted each other, since this is our main task in life for these 75 years, would you respond to the idea of what is wrong with accepting the idea of truth as a tentative collection of hypotheses?
Oh, certainly. I think that is a completely wrong, indefensible viewpoint. A hypothesis, if that term means anything, has to be used in contradistinction to a fact, to a truth that is known. A hypothesis means a possibility for which there is some but not conclusive evidence. You cannot even form such a concept until you first know what is conclusive evidence, what is knowledge. Only at a much later stage can you reach the point of saying certain complex questions, we don't yet have the full story, and therefore this is only a hypothesis. So in objectivist terms, to say everything is a hypothesis is to make the term hypothesis simply a stolen concept. It is very important that you go by evidence and come into conclusions. That's what going by reason consists of in practice. And going by evidence means committing yourself to certainty when the evidence is conclusive. If you say, well, 2 and 2 might be 4, but I don't want to commit myself because last week the Ford Hall had someone who said it was 3.5, and next week they'll have someone who says it's 5.5, you are defying reason in that act because it is not evidence that people disagree. The evidence in this case has to be the nature of the quantities involved, what the factual relationships are. This does not mean it's wrong for the Ford Hall to present a whole variety of contrary, conflicting viewpoints. What it does mean is that if you, as an educated member of the public, want to learn, you should listen to every speaker from the point of view of, is point X that he makes true or not? And if you don't come to that conclusion, it's a waste of time to sit there and listen to all these people. Any one of the speakers, I venture to say, if they care about what they're saying, want you to see their viewpoint is correct, and it's up to you to decide. The fact that they disagree doesn't mean the truth is A and non A. It means the onus is up to you to say, where does the evidence lie? And so the Ford Hall is doing you a service and giving you a variety of different pieces of evidence, but the moral is not, let's give up.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Will you join us next year? There was a question also further to the back. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead. The idea of a
fairness doctrine.
The question was that Ms. Rand once suggested an idea of a fairness doctrine for colleges and universities to see how they measured up. Do you agree with the idea of perpetrating a fairness doctrine?
Well, I would certainly like to perpetrate it, but I don't know how you could do it. Well, it's very dangerous to inject the government into academic questions. I understand very thoroughly that the government is already deeply injected, but I'm very hesitant about advocating as a solution that the government has to have an oversight into, there has to be so many on the right and so many on the left, because I would take my chances with even Harvard giving a better hearing to capitalism than a bureaucrat in some agency in Washington deciding who is going to represent the laissez-faire viewpoint. What I think the pressure should be brought is not the government, but by the students and by the alumni and by the contributors. Let them go to the university and say, I would be happy with the following. For every 99 professors teaching unreason and socialism, have one who is allowed to teach reason and capitalism. 1 to 100. If they would do that simply voluntarily, I'd have no fear for the future.
Question here in the back. There's a question in maroon here in the rear. Yes. Go ahead. Questioner is asking for a recommendation of an objectivist viewpoint of Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty.
And Gödel. Gödel's incompleteness theorem. No, I don't know where that is written. It will be at some point. I don't know any book that I could recommend to you on those questions. I'll simply say flatly to take Heisenberg that it's a gross confusion as commonly interpreted between epistemology and metaphysics. It says because you can't know the initial parameters, for instance, position and momentum within certain limits simultaneously, therefore you can't predict. And since you can't predict, therefore it's not determined. This jump, this completely grossly unwarranted inference from what we can't know to what is therefore not causally determined, is absolutely unwarranted, and is a reflection of the modern philosophical collapse. The most that Heisenberg established, if you even accept his science, is that you can know the original parameters within certain specified limits. That doesn't have any metaphysical implications whatever. Gödel is an even worse case, because the whole Gödel's approach, the incompleteness theorem, rests on the idea that axioms as such are unknowable. You cannot know a self-evident truth. Therefore, the only way to know whether an axiom is legitimate is to keep on churning out consequences and see whether next year or next decade you will come up with a contradiction. And since you never get to the end, you're always incomplete and you never can know. The whole theorem, the whole argument rests on the failure to grasp the proper method of validating axioms, and therefore is simply out of hand, out of a skeptical philosophy. I understand this is a very brief answer, but someday it will exist in print by somebody. I can't give you further specification.
Down toward the middle, perhaps. Yes, here in beige. Would you comment on the controversy over mutual destruction and the current Reagan administration statements on that?
Yes, by what I understand, I'm entirely opposed to what President Reagan said. I'm not a military expert, and I even hold as a philosophic view that civilians should not inject their views on technical military questions if they don't know what they're talking about. However,
it's all right here.
I think there is a philosophic point, as I understand what the president said, if I understand what he said. It's perfectly okay to say, let's develop some new form of technology which will protect us from attack by Russian weapons. No one can be against that, certainly I'm not. But to say, if he said, or if any of his advisors or friends or sympathizers are saying, we can therefore let slide our ability to launch massive nuclear military strikes against Russia, we can consider this, we don't have to worry about threatening them with destruction, I say that is disaster. You cannot put this country in the position where the entire initiative and strength lies with the destroyers of civilization, and all we can do is hope that there's some kind of shield, particularly when the president is saying once we get far enough advanced we'll share it with the Russians, which I heard him say in one speech. Beyond all this, of course, the whole thing is fantastically utopian. They're talking about the next century, and this simply serves to give appeasement to the people who are talking about disarmament. I think it is a very dangerous trend. I am a staunch, passionate, committed advocate of arming the United States to the teeth with every kind of weapon. With every kind of weapon, including nuclear weapons. And with making it clear to the Russians that if they dare to attack this country, they will be annihilated. and that is the only hope on which world peace can depend.
Let's come down through the front section here, and then I'll go around and back up the other side of the center. Yes, there's a question here.
I just wanted to know if you had a professorship anywhere, and if you had a medical practice in mind, if that is what you were going to do.
Are you undertaking another academic post somewhere, or have some more projects in mind?
I do not intend to take an academic position within the next year, but I am seriously considering going back to teaching in the near future. As to what I'll be doing in the next year or so, I have a lot of writing projects in mind. What will probably interest this audience is that I intend to bring out a substantial amount of material of different kinds by Ayn Rand, and that involves a lot of editing. Not only the book, The Unpublished Ayn Rand, which Mr. Rozell referred to, but also Ayn Rand's journals, her correspondence, and some of her lectures on writing, how to write fiction and how to write nonfiction. There is a lot of material by her that I consider of great value. It is not Atlas Shrugged at the Fountainhead. I don't have one of those. I wish I did. But there's a lot that I'm working on, which takes time. And in addition, I am seriously considering, I've actually started, in effect, a book, broadly speaking, on the mind-body question. But that's a project of years. So I don't think I'll go back to teaching right away.
And here in the front row. You're being asked if you would explain the difference between proof and validation.
Well, that's a technical, almost a semantic issue, but as I understand that distinction, validation is the broader term. Validation is any process of establishing the relation between an idea and reality. Any process of showing that that idea is based on reality. And for instance, you could be asked to validate an axiom, such as the law of identity. Not to prove it, but to validate. And you validate it by stating what it is, showing that it's self-evident, justifying the concept of the self-evident, saying what objective limits there are, by what criteria you determine what is and isn't self-evident, and so on. You do not prove in the sense of deduce or induce the axiom from earlier premises, because you cannot have any proof until you first have the axioms. So it's a more general term. Proof is a specific type of validation. It's validation, in other words, establishing the relation of an idea to reality by means of inference, whether deductive or inductive. But this is pretty technical.
I think that's really a very, very good place to end. And we thank you very much for being here with us.